We have lived through an extraordinary decade, says novelist Nadeem Aslam, beginning with 9/11 and ending with the Arab Spring, and he describes it as a clash between an incomplete understanding of the East and an incomplete understanding of the West. His fourth novel, The Blind Man's Garden, takes on that clash with the story about two young Pakistani men who travel to Afghanistan after 9/11 to care for wounded civilians and about the family that they've left behind. It's published by Alfred Knopf, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. Aslam to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Hello.
So in response to 9/11, on October 7, 2001, the United States launched what it called Operation Enduring Freedom with the United Kingdom and then a lot of other countries to attack the Taliban and al-Qaeda forces in conjunction with the Northern Alliance. And that led thousands of Pakistanis to volunteer to help the victims of the bombing that followed?
Exactly. That was the idea. And it's interesting that you mentioned the NATO attack, which I think I believe it's 46 countries that are in
most of the Western countries, but not all.
Indeed. And on the second page of the novel, the sentence I wrote, which is that the logic is that there are no innocent people in a guilty nation. And that really, for me, sums up a great deal of what has happened over the past decade, which you mentioned, the decade we've lived through, in that it began with 9/11, when it was decided that just because al-Qaeda disagrees with the policies of American government, everyone in America was guilty. And then the response to it was that autumn that just because the Taliban and al-Qaeda won't do what we ask them to do, which is to hand over Osama bin Laden and the...
They refused.
Therefore, everyone in Afghanistan came in harm's way. And the number, I think, is 10,000. About 10,000 young men from Pakistan went, and they were most of them were slaughtered because the Taliban put them on the front lines.
And they went because they got caught up in the spirit of jihad?
Absolutely, yes. And one of the things that has happened, and it's very humiliating as a writer who spends his days looking at words and who is in love with words, is how words have been corrupted over the past 10 decades. George Orwell said in 1946 that political language is designed to hide murder.
And that's why we have a Department of Defense, not a Department of War in this country.
Exactly. And so we keep hearing these things, these words like extraordinary rendition. What that really means is kidnapping. And people talk about enhanced interrogation. I think what they're talking about is torture. And this is not just the American side I'm talking about, because this thing that appeared in my mind was because you use the word jihad. Now, jihad has as many meanings as a rose has petals. You know, to smile at someone when you don't feel like smiling is actually jihad. To be kind to someone when your own life is full of mean things is jihad. But these people, the Taliban and al-Qaeda, want that word reduced to just one thing, which is their meaning. And I always say, and one of the impulses behind The Blind Man's Garden was, I always said that I became a Muslim on 9/11. That before 9/11, if someone had asked me, are you a Muslim? I would have said, well, you know, I drink, I smoke, I've never prayed, I don't fast, I don't really believe in God. So in a way, I'm culturally a Muslim, but I'm not. But after 9/11, when someone asks me, are you a Muslim? I say, yes, I am. In that now it's become important to tell the non-Muslim world that someone who looks like me and someone who behaves like me is also Muslim. I want to send a message to al-Qaeda and Taliban as well, that I refuse to let you decide what a Muslim is.
Now, your father was a communist poet. I assume that he was a non-believer as well.
Indeed.
How common is that in Pakistan?
Well, I think that is... there is no such survey, but certainly there are people in my life who are non-believers. I always say that I always think of a prism with a beam of white light going into it and splitting up into seven colors. So it depends on what you think a Pakistani or a Muslim is. If you look, stand on the white side of the beam, you think it's only a uniform set of behaviors. But if you look at the other side, it's an entire spectrum.
Well, you moved to England when you were
14.
14 because your father had to flee the persecution of Zia-ul-Haq, who had instituted Sharia law into Pakistan. So did Pakistan change at that point?
Yes. I mean, the texture of daily life completely changed. I mean, they were like public whippings and what have you, and the draconian blasphemy laws came in and what have you, and all of these things that I mention in the novel. At the age of 14, I ended up in England with very little English, and by law you have to be in school until you're 16. So when I went to school in England, my English wasn't very good. I did well in sciences, because for sciences your English needn't be that good. All you need to do is assimilate facts and then reproduce them. But the subjects I wanted to study were things like literature and history and politics, etc., etc. But I couldn't do that. So it took me a long time to learn English. And
you did it to some degree, I gather, by transcribing some pretty great novels.
I did.
Well, you chose wisely some incredible authors, but did you have to choose books that were that long? I mean, Herman Melville.
Moby Dick. I wrote out the whole of Moby Dick by hand.
And Ulysses.
I wanted to see what a comma felt. I wanted to see what a full stop was. I wanted to see how much thought you can have per page, how many images you can have per paragraph. So I copied out Herman Melville. I copied out As I Lay Dying, Faulkner's great novel. I copied out Bruno Schulz, The Street of Crocodiles. I copied out Beloved by Toni Morrison.
And also Nabokov.
Nabokov, Lolita, The Autumn of the Patriarch by Marquez. All these things are because this isn't my first language. The first sentence of The Blind Man's Garden is, history is the third parent. In that, so I had a mother and father, but there was someone else present who made sure that I left my country and ended up in another place, and I had to begin a new life with this third parent.
And one of your reviewers pointed out that ideology can be your fourth parent.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about history being your third parent. In other words, you're really saying that no matter how your parents bring you up, the circumstances that surround
it's
your life
a great presence, of course.
Wind up having an incredible effect, just like the environment and the culture does.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about how English can often distort words. Does the same thing happen with in Urdu, especially since you grew up at a time when somebody had effected a coup and was imposing a totalitarian government on the country?
Yes, I will. I mean, as I said earlier about the word jihad. So, you know, and so these things are being imposed onto daily life. Like, for example, we were told, the teachers were told that you can't say two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen come together to form one molecule of water, H2O. They were said, say two atoms of hydrogen plus one atom of oxygen come together, if God wills, to form one molecule of water. So that kind of thing, that religion had to be present in everything. But for me, religion was always about consequence. And I'm grateful that that lesson entered my life, which is that I was told that if you do something good, the result will be good. If you do something bad, the result will be bad.
But are you a practicing Muslim?
I'm an atheist.
So you're a cultural Muslim.
I'm a cultural. The sound of the muezzin does something to me. It doesn't make me want to go to the mosque, but it does something to me.
My guess is Nadim Aslam, his latest book, The Blind Man's Garden. Now, you have horrific descriptions of what was going on in Afghanistan after the invasion. Were you a witness to any of this?
Nothing in the novel is made up. I mean, I don't have this kind of imagination. But
so you wrote this as though it were a work of nonfiction, except you wrote it in your style as a fiction writer.
Exactly. I mean, there are sort of newspaper reports. I base these things, and I know the events that you are referring to, these three or four sequences in the novel, but they are very difficult. But I always say that if something terrible is happening in the world, I wish to know about it so that I can become galvanized about, and I can become upset and eventually try to do something about them. And what's the alternative? Not knowing about the bad things in the world and going around thinking, don't I live in a beautiful world?
But you also write in a very lyrical style. Sometimes lyricism fights against describing horrific events.
Exactly. And that is... I wouldn't say there is this misconception by writers out there that you write a page simply and then you go and prettify it. You go and make it lyrical. You make three grams of images and 4 ounces of similes, and that is not how it works. A sentence comes to me the way it comes.
Does it come to you partly because it's English is your second language?
I really
Because Urdu is a language of literature as well.
Indeed. And of great literature. The Irish writer John Banville said about Nabokov that Nabokov didn't write in English. He wrote in a private, secret language that was somehow comprehensible to English-speaking people. And I think at some level, that is true of all writers. So I really don't...
Because you're inventing a language when you're writing.
Exactly. And I don't really want to examine too much where my words come from. I think I want the mystery to remain. But of course, I want to communicate. So some of that mystery has to go away, but I like some of it to remain.
Now, the novel also tells the stories of one of these boys' relatives in Pakistan, including his father, Rohan, the blind man of the title, mm-hmm. his wife, and his mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. What does the blind man's garden represent?
The first line of chapter 3 is that the boundary wall of the garden is draped with poet's jasmine, and that's Pakistan's national flower. And so the garden for me is Pakistan, meaning a nation which was built in the name of Islam, and then throughout the its history and throughout the course of the novel we see how the ideals have become corrupted.
But you're also suggesting you can kind of identify a nation by the its own odors, especially its flora.
Yes.
You walk into a garden, you say, this is a Pakistani garden. You walk into another garden and say, is an English garden.
Well, aren't there Italian gardens? Aren't there French gardens? And of course, I have to say that. I mean, the first flower I smelled was a Pakistani flower. The first bird I heard was a Pakistani bird, which we don't have here.
Now, in your novel, is it Mikal?
Mikal.
His father has been disappeared for being a communist, mm-hmm. and your father, was he threatened with that?
I think anyone who tries to tell the truth about the powerful in the world is in danger when the powerful think that they can get away with it. So, yes, he was a... My father's story is quite strange in that when he was young, he wrote poems which were published. But by the time he was in his mid-20s and he was developing as a writer, he had to go out and find a job because his father died and he had responsibilities to look after the family. So all my life, I felt that there was a kind of wound in my father, that he felt his real life didn't happen because he had to go out and earn money, as it were. And so in all my novels up until now, I've written 4 novels and I have 11 more novels to write.
You have 11 more, you know for sure?
Yes, I
do. You have them all kind of figured out?
Yes, I do. And in all of them, the great Pakistani poet is called Wamak Saleem, which was the name my father wrote under. So I've done for my father in the universe of my books what he couldn't do in real life because of me.
These books, to some degree, are your way of honoring your father.
Indeed.
You've written that, I'm quoting, most of my anger is not directed at the boys who become terrorists. Suicide bombers are just bullets, just knives. My rage is aimed at the terrorist leaders, the people who lead the confused, rudderless young men astray. Mm. Was this novel a way of addressing that rage?
Absolutely. It's. I always say that news is the most emotional program on TV for me, or on radio, that there are things that I see, and I don't know people who are not writers how they deal with when they see something upsetting. My way of dealing with something upsetting on the radio news is to say, I will one day write about this.
But Pakistan is so confusing in that regard. For example, Zia both supported the Americans mm-hmm. and also supported the Taliban.
That's
he
right.
gave money That's to the madrasas right. yeah. where the Taliban formed.
It's called dishonesty. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised. These things exist anyway, you know.
So, but also, you get the feeling here that the Americans in the book are ideologues even more than the flag burners who become convenient totems of Muslim rage, mm-hmm. as you call them. Americans won't recognize themselves in that way. We saw ourselves as victims of fanatics on 9/11.
So the sentence of which I quoted earlier, that there are no innocent people in a guilty nation. That was my anger at Al-Qaeda, that you simply cannot hold a nation, the people within a nation, for what its administration does. And frankly, I mean, I always said that I could live anywhere if I loved someone. So for me, nations and boundaries don't mean anything. What America, what Britain, what Pakistan, what Australia, you know? So boundaries and nations are irrelevant as far as I am concerned. I am concerned with the human.
Now, just one more thing. We have very little time. I gather that your writing process can be rather intense. You sometimes black out your windows, stay inside for weeks at a time, even covered your eyes during the writing of this so you could understand blindness. And that. Yeah. And I read that you were so absorbed in your writing on September 11th that you didn't know it had happened until September 20th?
That's right. I was, because I wouldn't say I was poor, because I think an artist is never poor. But I had no money. And once, and I would work on construction sites to earn money. And once I had that money, I would then try to put away as many distractions as possible, and I would lock myself in a room and write. I feel guilty to this day if I eat and I haven't written that day, that I don't deserve that food, I say to myself.
Nadeem Aslam will be speaking at the Penn World Voices Festival today at 4 o'clock. He'll be in a panel discussion of contemporary writers on the classics. That's at the Baruch Performing Arts Center at 65 Lexington Avenue. His latest novel, 11 More to Come, this one's called The Blind Man's Garden, and it's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a real pleasure.